are listening to Democracy Watch, the News Collective's weekly, hour-long, alternative current affairs report. I'm Alex DeBoer.
I'm Samuel Jones.
And I'm Lyndon Wong.
And I'm Chinar Kipper.
And I'm Andy Laidman.
It's Thursday, March 21st at 5:04 p.m. We're broadcasting from UBC's Vancouver campus on the ancestral, traditional, and unceded territories of the Hunkamino-speaking Musqueam people.
And on today's show, you're going to hear the News Collective's take on the federal budget media bailout.
Because I thought that, like, though I knew this thing was going to be tailor-made to make sure that, like, Post Media gets most of it, followed by Torstar, followed by, you know, Globe and Mail, Irving's, et cetera, I thought that they would at least make some, like, gestures towards, like, see, we've got some digital recipients here. And it's actually just atrocious. Rather than just screed on here, why don't I just read from this thing? As we knew, a panel of independent journalists will be government appointed. It will be their job to determine who is a QCJO. I see you wondering, what is that?
What is a QCJO, Jesse?
I'm so glad you asked. It's a Qualified Canadian Journalistic Organization.
All right. So you are listening to Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM. That was a clip of Jesse Brown from Canada Land, everyone's favorite podcast. Or some people like it. I like it. Anyway. Jesse was sharing his opinion on the federal media bailout, which is we're going to get into right away. Sam's going to lead us in that. Sam, do you want to take it?
Yeah, so I'll just start off. The 2019 federal budget includes in its tax measures a plan to support Canadian journalism. The way the Liberal budget plans to do this is through a refundable labor tax credit, a non-refundable tax credit for subscriptions to Canadian digital news, and by giving certain journalistic organizations who qualify for it a donee status.
So yeah, basically the government of Canada provides support to different organizations in a few different categories that operate for a broad public purpose, such as charities. The introduction of journalistic organizations means that if they fit the mold, the Canadian government feels a journalistic donee they'll be given tax exemptions and benefits along with their online subscribers.
Canadians who donate to charity can claim a charitable donation on their tax credit if they donate to a donee. In a similar vein, with the introduction of these rules, Canadians can claim a tax credit on their subscriptions, which will be worth 15% of what they paid, with the limit set at $500, meaning the most they could get back if they just can't stop subscribing to online news is $75.
So what's really interesting about that is the labor tax credit, which has a perhaps unexpected caveat. Journalistic organizations who qualify will have access to a tax credit for labor costs for newsroom employees that they can then claim equal to 25% of their employees' income. This caps at $55,000, meaning that these organizations will be making a maximum of $13,500 back from their employees' salary that they're paying out. However, to qualify for this particular credit, you need to be a partnership or trust primarily engaged in the production of original written news content. Any Canadian news organization engaged in a broadcasting venture will not qualify for the credit.
So there are a few rules when it comes to what journalistic organizations qualify. A qualified Canadian journalist organization will be required to be organized as a corporation, partnership, or trust, and actually be in Canada. Also, the chairman will have to be Canadian, along with 75% of the board of directors.
Organizations that qualify will also have to be primarily focused on matters of general interest, and so that means politics and current events in Canada. They can't be covering industry-specific news or promoting goods and services or particular political factions within Canada.
And they also can't be crown corporations, government agencies, or municipal corporations. So that's all the particularly important stuff out of the way. And we thought it would be a good idea to call some folks who know their stuff and ask them what they think.
And before we get to those interviews, which are with folks from the Taiyi and the Narwhal, a Victoria publication, I just wanted to have a little bit of a roundtable discussion unpacking what we just talked about. So we just went over a lot of information. Let's go through it and break it down a little bit more. So Sam, you started off by saying the 2019 federal budget includes this plan to support Canadian journalism. So why is Canadian journalism in need of support, just for folks who might not know?
Well, I mean, it's kind of a bit of a clash between cultures in some way, with a sort of defund CBC crowd and the people who feel differently. And you could explain that in in looking at kind of the statement the Liberal government is making here, and mm-hmm. also with the way that a lot of news organizations have struggled as of late. We hear about layoffs all the time,
yeah.
and those sorts of things. And I think they're trying to consolidate Canadian media in general. Also, the strength of an independent Canadian media. Like, if you look here, we went over. They want the people in charge of these companies to actually be Canadians.
Yeah.
And so by giving them tax breaks, the idea would be to give them a competitive edge. And so it's very in line with a lot of what the government has done in the past and going forward into the future, which is protecting Canadian media outlets in general. And in this case, it's journalistic outlets.
Right. So let's just you said a couple of important things there. So media lately has been struggling. The news in general has been struggling, even globally. Big companies like Google, online companies have cut into ad revenue that journalistic outlets normally have gotten. People have stopped paying because a lot of news is available online for free. So we have this sort of crisis where people are being laid off, as you said. It's harder for news outlets to stay afloat. And then there's the second piece, like you said, that the government wants to keep Canadian news alive. We always exist sort of in the shadow of America, right? So there's this effort with the CBC and other things like the Canadian Radio and Television Commission, ensuring that we public broadcasters or community radio broadcasters, but who are broadcasting to the Canadian public, play a certain percent of like Canadian music and content, right? So yeah, there's this other piece that is to make sure that we keep Canadian news alive so that we're not just hearing about Donald Trump.
Yeah, and I'm glad you mentioned that about advertising, because I think that's a lot what the tax credit for the online subscriptions is for, is to encourage mm-hmm. people to actually pay for their news rather than just sort of put up with pop-ups and watch ads on sites.
Right. So in terms of the rest of this, this media bailout, I'm interested in the charity aspect. If a Canadian news organization registers, they become a donee, or how does this work?
So donees are a specific kind of organization that the federal tax code sort
right.
of recognizes.
So it's not actually, I think this is key though, that the Liberals are not actually making news organizations into nonprofits. Instead, they're like a slightly different.
No, what they're doing is they're creating a new category.
Yeah,
they're not necessarily trying to reshape news organizations into charities. They're just saying if you fit a certain bill, if you fit a certain mold, if you're a Canadian news organization that's covering current affairs and not specific industry stuff, then you are going to be in fact sort of recognized as a donee and can sort of reap the benefits of the tax advantages therein that we've sort of assigned to this category.
Right, and the tax benefits are, Chinar, you can probably speak
to
this.
I'd like to add a little something. I mean, everything else in this program, aside from the qualified donee status, is kind of a handout. I mean, so that within 5 years, it's being given to support, say, labor costs and everything. The qualified donee status actually fundamentally changes how these institutions can be funded even after the handout period is over. So it is going to be interesting seeing, like, if there's going to be long-term benefits to this temporary support provided to Canadian media, it is going to be coming from the qualified donee status change.
So, sorry, could you just elaborate a little bit? In what way is this sort of a long-term benefit,
this media bailout, as we're calling it, is actually only for 5 years of supports. And eventually, that is obviously after 5 years, it's going to stop.
Right.
But the donee status, it's going to continue. And excellent. That is going to be able to provide different avenues of revenue for media outlets. So it is going to be interesting. Actually, one of the guests that we interviewed has talked about that more extensively.
Cool. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really key, is that this is only for 5 years. This mm-hmm. fund is meant to spread over 5 years. What else about what we went over should we detangle?
Well, the refundable labor tax credit.
Yeah, the labor tax credit. Yeah.
That is also very significant. And obviously, the way it works is basically per employee, the government essentially is going to be covering up to $13,750 per per employee.
Yes.
Which, of course, means that's very large institutions, does, like, say.
But can I say, is that amount dependent on how much the employee makes?
Yes. And that's going to be a maximum. Like, it's
okay,
going to be
capped.
Okay. Exactly. So not everybody is not going to get that, but basically it's going to be, exactly, it's going to come to that amount. It's going to be the most that they can get. And what this, of course, means is that very large organizations that employ many people, say Postmedia, Torstar, and everything, are, of course, going to see much more benefit to this than the smaller outlets. And how they utilize the money is actually one of the more controversial aspects. I mean, the idea being this money that they're saving from labor, is it going to be invested in things that benefit Canadian media? Is it just going to be buying a second yacht? Nobody knows.
For their CEOs. Well, this is, yeah, exactly. And when I was listening to the latest episode of Canada Land, which I would encourage everyone to listen to, I forget the title of it, but in the at the end of the episode, Jesse Brown does talk about this media bailout. And, yeah, he talks about this issue of transparency. So the government actually isn't going to, first of all, tell the public how much money is going into each organization, from what I understand. And then the organization isn't, like, I don't know if this is so much transparency, but they're not obligated to spend the money in any specific way, which is what you're saying.
Exactly.
So, like, sure, they're getting, say, maybe they get $13,500 for an employee that makes $55,000 a year. That doesn't mean that's going to go into that employee's salary. That doesn't mean that journalist is going to make that much more necessarily. It might mean that they're going to buy new computers, or the CEO just makes more money.
Ideally, they would be hiring more people. I mean, there's, like, the most optimistic reading of this is that there will be some trickle-down effect where, you know,
if you believe in that.
Exactly. That's, as Jesse actually mentioned, like, that's, it might help out freelancers. It might help out expand staff and everything. And right now, one of the, when we say the crisis of journalism, we're basically talking about the precarity of the field. I mean, both for the journalists, there's a precarity, and also for the outlets themselves. Now, if this is used to actually benefit the journalists, this could definitely improve the quality and longevity of Canadian media.
Mm-hmm.
But if it's just used to, for example, you know, buy out smaller media outlets and consolidate everything, that's just going to be exacerbating an existing problem.
Yeah.
That's been going on for like 50 years, so it's not even a new problem of consolidation.
Yeah, that's already been going on, especially with the Irvings in Eastern Canada.
Exactly.
So one thing that I think is interesting, too, is the issue of freelance journalists. Because, you know, let's be realistic. We, you know, work as journalists, or like I do and Chinar does. And, you know, you guys do to a smaller extent. But, you know, as freelancers, you can be working for multiple organizations, you know, pitching content, making stories. And even if you're working regularly, say, for the Globe and Mail or the Vancouver Sun, it doesn't mean that... well, for a larger organization, they might be getting money anyway. But say you're freelancing for a smaller organization that might not qualify, like the TAI or maybe whatever organization. As a freelancer, this won't necessarily help you. So, like, they didn't take an individual approach. They could have instead said something like, okay, if you're an individual journalist and you're producing, like, X amount of work and you're making X amount of money or whatever qualification, then you could get some money. But instead, it's very top-down. It's like the money's coming through these large legacy media organizations and kind of maybe falling down a bit, which is, it's really interesting. And another thing that was interesting that, Sam, you said sort of right out of the gate was that the media bailout is only going to go to organizations that produce text.
Well, that being their primary function. Yeah, so that being their what they mostly do.
Yeah.
The only thing it says, you know, you're not going to qualify for the tax credit, like, outright, is broadcasting ventures. And I looked in the Canadian broad, because it says as outlined by the Canadian Broadcasting Act. I looked in the act. It's very long. I couldn't find the specific text on broadcasting ventures, but they define broadcasting as you would think it would be. So just radio, right?
Like, so we don't get any money?
No, we don't. We don't get any money. Because CITR and Discorder, I imagine, are equivocated. I don't think.
What does that mean?
Well, I don't know if the Canadian government would be like, Discorder's 80% of what you do, so here's some money, even though, like, if they think, like, Discorder's the primary function of the thing, right?
Yes.
I don't know if that's what they would think.
Yeah, yeah. I know I thought about that, because we do have a magazine called Discorder, which is print, is text, so...
But even if it were the case that CITR was a smaller part of this, it's still a broadcasting venture.
Yeah.
But then again, I wonder if they define venture as for profit. So I couldn't find the language in the bill,
totally.
So I don't know.
Totally.
But I imagine we might have wiggle room there where it's not maybe considered a venture because we're not trying to make money. I don't know. I just
totally.
Don't.
But
nonprofits are applying too. So
yeah, nonprofits.
Shouldn't be a problem. Nonprofits are applying.
Yeah. So. But this brings up a good point is that, you know, this budget was just released early this week. This media bailout was just outlined. So, like, there are a lot of questions that are going to come up that the government will have to answer. And, you know, I think that's, you know, reasonable that, like, all these little details might not be totally fleshed out yet. Or maybe it's not reasonable, but it is the case. So we just simply don't know. So in terms of also text-only or, you know, primarily text-only organizations getting funding, that does cut out podcasts, which are dear to my heart. So if you have, like, a podcast company, which, you know, barely anyone can make it doing that anyway, and you're making news podcasts, doesn't count. So...
And of course, another major problem is that this was kind of, as Jesse pointed out in Candleland, this is kind of designed to help out legacy media. So how its impact on startups, I mean, one of the stipulations is that something be classified as a qualified Canadian journalism organization. But the...
Right, there's
exactly,
that whole thing.
We already went into that. But the barrier to that can be quite high for new startups. I mean, which is usually just some journalist who's trying to see what he can do with a passion of love, but they won't have two employees that they've employed over a year, for example. That's one stipulation.
Well, So to get any of this money, like, first of all, there's all these rules, but to prove that you meet these rules, you have to go before a panel of your peers, which is in the form of a qualified Canadian journalistic, you need to qualify before a jury of your peers as a qualified Canadian journalistic organization. So that whole thing is...
Yeah, and that is, of course, that can be very stringent, and that is not pro-entrepreneurial
startups. Like, who are these people
going to
be?
Exactly. Oh, that's another issue.
We don't know.
Nobody is sure about who the assembly is going to be or the council is going to be. But, of course, certain rules just basically disqualify newcomers. I mean, the hardest one is it regularly one necessary condition is it regularly employs two or more journalists in the production of its content who deal at arm's length with the organization. So startups usually do not have two full-time staff.
Yeah.
I mean, they might eventually get to that point, but they're usually starting off usually sometimes as a labor of love, you know, not even really just taking volunteer time at some point. So they wouldn't qualify.
Yeah.
So, and this seems like, looking at this as an overall package, it does seem more concerned with sort of preserving larger legacy media than helping new entrepreneurial startups.
Yeah, totally. It's interesting. You can get so philosophical in this stuff. Like, what is news? What, you know, who qualifies? Like, it can get so nebulous. And so anyway, let's bring this news back to the local. And Chinar, you did a couple of interviews today, which is awesome, with some local news organizations. And so we want to hear what they think of this federal budget and the media bailout that's contained within it. And though we don't know all the specifics yet, there's still enough in here to get a sense of how this is going to work. So do you want to introduce the first interview, Chinar?
Of course. The first interview was Jeanette Ageson, publisher of The Tai, based in Vancouver. And it is she was optimistic, but cautious, because she, as I said, like, she was the one who really clued me in on the fact that this is more about helping out legacy than necessarily helping out entrepreneurial startups.
Yeah. Let's take a listen.
Take it from the beginning. Can I get your name, please?
Jeanette Ageson.
Mm-hmm. And your position at the TAI?
I'm the publisher.
Publisher, okay. So can you please, as we talked a second ago, regarding the media bailout proposals within the budget 2019, can you give me a basic overview of what you think, of how you feel about it?
How I feel about it? I think it depends. It's It depends on what sort of future state they are trying to get to. I mean, it's no secret that the journalism sector has been hard hit over a pretty long time, and we've been seeing a lot of newsrooms, you know, lay off a lot of their reporters, or a lot of papers just completely shut, and a lot of communities are left completely without any reporting capacity on their civic institutions like City Hall or their legislature, and that is something that needs to be taken action on. So if this package does that and brings more reporting back to communities and makes a strong independent journalism ecosystem, then it could be a good thing. But it's the devils are really in the details, and it's really not clear how the policy is going to play out in the real world.
Thank you. So have you had a chance to look over the detailed budget section? It was on the business income tax measures for support for Canadian journalism.
Briefly. I mean, to be honest, it's actually not that detailed. There's a lot of gray area and a lot of details that haven't been announced. And also, they both gave some initial criteria, but they also reiterated that there will be this independent panel that hasn't been named yet that will be determining the final criteria. So I really don't have a sense how set in stone this criteria is, if it's a jumping off point, or whether this independent panel will be able to change things at all.
Okay, so the budget actually involves includes a section called the Qualified Canadian Journalism Organizations. And have you had a chance to look at that? Because from what I'm looking at, it seems to set a very interesting bar where... And this was actually discussed on the Canadaland podcast last night as well, I believe. I don't know if you have been able to listen to it, but essentially it's setting this bar where has to be, I mean, the details are quite stringent, for, and a lot of smaller new media startups, for example, would not qualify. It's basically set up in such a way that qualified Canadian journalism organizations qualified Canadian journalism organizations need to be established large institutions practically. If you are a new, if you are a independent journalist trying to start up something new, you would not qualify for any of these. You know, you need two employees, all these other things. What are your views on that?
Yeah, if you look at it like that, it's definitely, it's not sort of an entrepreneurship incubator kind of policy. It's not. It doesn't seem to be encouraging new things to spring up. It looks like it's meant to support, established players. Or if there are like newer digital startups, they need to have been going for enough time to have stable enough funding to have two regular employees. So yeah, if you look at it like that, it's definitely not directed at the brand new players who don't have that kind of stability yet.
Do you think that the TAIE would qualify?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Like, is the TAIE going to apply more specifically?
Well, I don't say what we... I can't say what we will or won't do. In the future, we haven't really had a chance to wrap our mind around it, but I don't see why we wouldn't if everyone else would be, and if it wouldn't hamper our independence in any way.
Now, some of the qualifications that are needed involve, for example, there has to be text heavy and everything. It has to be text. What about like media outlets that, for example, podcasts, for example? How do you feel? I mean, should they be left out? Should they not?
Yeah, it was very interesting to see that in there. I think it's a very narrow conception on what media is and how people consume media. I mean, I consume a lot of podcasts myself, and it's one of the primary ways that I get my news information. I was quite surprised to see that shut out. But if you look at maybe where their starting point is, it's really the text-based news organizations that have been shrinking, so that probably seems like the squeakiest wheel, whereas podcasting is a little bit newer. There wasn't sort of a long history of podcasting that has now just been decimated, so yeah.
Because from what I understand, something like, say, The Globe, which obviously is text-based, also has podcast divisions. And once they qualify as one of those qualified Canadian media outlets, then they can also use the funding for the podcast division. So it seems to me that it would cause some, you know, a lot of unfair competition almost for straight podcasters who don't have the means to, you know, they would now be competing with federally funded competitors.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, yeah, a big player. They might have, you know, if they have a staff of three people working on a podcast, they, you know, they could have up to $36,000 of subsidized salary, whereas a podcast producer that was just doing podcasts, they wouldn't be able to use that subsidy.
What do you think about this personal income tax credit for digital subscriptions? Will that affect TIE at all?
No, it wouldn't affect us because we don't have traditional subscriptions. We don't have a paywall. So all of our stuff is free to read. So, I mean, people do support us with sort of voluntary contributions, but I don't think that those would qualify as subscriptions.
Okay. Okay, so just last question. Overall, how would you how do you feel about this? I mean, do you think that it will... we already discussed that it's not very entrepreneur-friendly. It seems more about helping out existing legacy, particularly. I mean, it seems that's going to be, you know, Post-Media, Torstar, Globe, that are going to be really feeling most of the benefit here. How would you rate this? I mean, what could be improved? What is controversial in your view?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's controversial. You could have... particular read of this and try to put yourself in the shoes of someone who was trying to construct a bailout that would go to the big players and see how they might have put that together into this package. However, having said that, I don't know the motivation of the people who put it together. I don't have any evidence of what they're trying to do, so I can't say what they were trying to do. But you can see that this package, it's a lot more beneficial to the legacy players than to the new digital startups, people that are trying things out with very little support as it is. I think that's kind of unfortunate. There are really exciting things going on with people who have been doing it with absolutely no support. And the TIE, like, we've been around for 15 years. We've, you know, been operating with a shoestring budget the entire time. And when I think of the impact that we're able to have with the kind of budget we have compared to the big players, I think that if you had many small experiments like the TIE going across the country, I think you might be able to see a bit more impact than some, you know, just feeding it to the gigantic organizations without mandating that they change anything. Like, there's nothing in this package that forces them to change any of their practices. So that's a little disappointing as well.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. That was very helpful.
No worries.
The program will actually be at 5, but if I can get your email, I can send you the link.
Sure.
Okay. So thank you very much. Have a good day.
Okay.
And that was Jeanette Ageson, and she said a lot of things, and she is, like I said, overall optimistic, but the thing that really stuck with me was about how, while this is going to be more legacy-focused, again, it doesn't really help out new startups, and that's what I think is really where, if there's going to be any salvation of Canadian media, it has to also incorporate new voices that are coming in.
Yeah, totally. Definitely. So we have one more piece. This is the next one's with someone from the Narwhal.
Yes, Emma Gilchrist, editor-in-chief of Victoria-based The Narwhal. And she is quite optimistic. She feels that this is a positive step towards saving Canadian media, actually, which is what it was billed as when it was first mentioned at the end of last year. So
excellent.
Let's listen to her views.
Yeah, and if you just tuned in, you're listening to Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM. We're talking about the federal media bailout, which was included in their recent budget. So let's go to this interview with the editor-in-chief of The Narwhal, Emma Gilchrist. Here we go.
So, can I please get your name?
Yeah, it's Emma Gilchrist.
And your position at The Narwhal?
I'm the editor-in-chief of The Narwhal.
Okay. So, as you know, the budget 2019 released a somewhat controversial media support for Canadian journalism section. Can you give us an overview of why it is important, or your views on it, how you feel it's helpful, not helpful, just a general
overview? There are three elements of the measures to support Canadian journalism that were announced in the budget this week. One of them is labor rebates, which will give journalism organizations money back for the journalists who they employ. The second part is creating a special type of qualified donee status for journalism organizations that qualify so that news organizations will be able to issue tax receipts and receive charitable donations. And the third is a tax credit for digital subscriptions. So there's a few different things going on there. I mean, overall, I see this announcement as a significant step towards supporting the news sector in Canada. It's certainly been controversial, and it seems that everybody has a different view on it. But from the perspective of somebody running a small digital media outlet, I think these changes will provide support to many, organizations like ours. And I think the government is on the right track with the qualifying criteria, but they certainly could be improved.
In which ways could they be improved?
So for the labor rebates, for instance, and the budget says that an independent committee is yet to be announced to fine-tune these criteria. But for the labor rebate, for instance, they're rebating up to $13,750 per journalist, and there's no cap on that. So some of the big publications could end up with, millions of dollars from that. And so I do think a cap on that would even the playing field somewhat. Another thing is in order to qualify for these labor rebates, they've put in place a rule that news outlets need to have at least two employees. And the problem with that rule is that it discriminates against startups, essentially. Many journalism startups don't have two employees, let alone two full-time employees or close to full-time employees. And so I think that rule is going to make it tough for many startups to qualify. And also the two-employee rule kind of overlooks the role of freelancers and contractors in journalism. And freelancers and contractors are, very heavily relied upon in our sector, and the labor costs of that are not recognized anywhere in this package. So I think that could be improved as well.
I would like to ask in a minute about the things that you mentioned, how it does help, and the problem with, say, startups and everything. One thing that caught my eye was this qualified Canadian journalism organizations. The bar they've set for it seems, as you mentioned, like quite difficult. Aside from just the two, it also has a whole bunch of other rules. It must not be significantly engaged in this. It must be primarily focused on matters of general interest. Can't be focused on any particular specific news or sports or recreation industry specific news or sports or recreation. I mean, it kind of feels very limiting to what it can provide. Support for. Do you have any ideas on that?
I mean, I think that the criteria, they do need to be quite strict to ensure that, public money is going to support real journalists doing public interest work. So I do think that a lot of the criteria they have outlined do make sense. But the criteria, you know, around that seems to be excluding publications that are focused on a particular topic, such as industry-specific news, sports, recreation, et cetera, I think that really needs clarifying. The language is quite vague right now, and it's not clear who's going to be in and who's going to be out. I think, you know, what they're trying to get at is that it needs to have a general audience, that this can't be like a trade publication, for instance. Okay. And it's also trying to rule out supporting, you know, kind of soft news. So it's really trying to gear it towards public interest news, but I don't think they've necessarily nailed that criteria just yet. Okay. There's a few parts throughout the budget measures where the language is quite imprecise and it's difficult to tell what exactly they're meaning. And I expect that language to become much clearer once it goes through the committee process.
For the listeners, the exact line is, must not be primarily focused on a particular topic such as industry-specific news, sports, recreation, arts, lifestyle, or entertainment. So yes, it is. It seems that it's so. It just has to be general news, from what I understand, and current events. Okay.
Yeah, I mean the narwhal is a good example, right? Through a strict reading of that, you know, somebody might say that we are focused on a particular topic, so perhaps we would not qualify. Mm. I, however, am choosing to read this as though we would qualify. I'm quite confident that we will qualify. We are focused on energy and environment news, but I believe that is general interest enough that we wouldn't be excluded by that rule. But it certainly needs to be clarified. Mm-hmm.
As for the other stuff that you mentioned, there is the qualified donee status. There's the refundable labor tax credit that you mentioned. Of course, if you are something gigantic like Post Media or Torstar, then, of course, that's going to be it's really going to help out legacy media more, that refundable tax credits, which comes to $13,750 per employee. And of course, there's the personal income tax credit for digital subscriptions. So those are all the things that are included. Would you add anything else to this?
Well, I think that the area of the budget that is being kind of most overlooked is this qualified donee status. And that is a really important change in Canadian law. In the U.S., there are more than 200 nonprofit news organizations, you know, many really substantive public interest news outlets who are funded through philanthropy. And the nonprofit news sector in Canada has really been tiny in comparison, and that's because news organizations in Canada have not been able to accept charitable donations. So it's really hampered the growth of our industry. And the Narwhal is one of Canada's only nonprofit news outlets, so we see this as a very important change. And the criteria are even stricter to qualify under this category. But I think it's, you know, the criteria should be strict because these outlets are going to receive, you know, a public tax benefit for doing the work. So we want to make sure that they're, you know, that they're doing work in the public interest and, you know, that they aren't controlled by any, you know, particular special interest, any particular donor, that they're transparent about who their donors are, and that they have an arm's-length board of directors. So I think the criteria they've outlined there actually make a lot of sense, although it will be challenging for a lot of organizations to meet them.
Will the Narwhal meet them?
We anticipate being able to meet them. They come in 2020, and we have been disclosing our donors for the last couple of years, so we're in a good position. I think, you know, the points that are going to create challenges for some organization is this rule about not having any single gift represent more than 20% of your revenue. That's going to be challenging for many organizations, including ours, but we are diversifying our funding and increasingly are funded by our readers, so we anticipate being able to meet that rule. And the disclosure one is going to be hard for some organizations as well, I think, because there's a whole kind of process of kind of donor education around having people agree, you know, that their information is going to be public if they donate. And, you know, that's a challenging conversation, and it's one that is hard to have after the fact. So it might take a little bit of time for, you know, organizations to be able to start to meet these standards.
Okay. So I guess a couple last questions. It's overall, though, you do think that it's good, that it is, that it does protect Canadian media. And one thing I actually am curious about is this digital media startups, though. What can they hope to get from this?
I mean, for an organization like ours, you know, we expect to benefit from the labor rebates, you know, to the tune of, you know, somewhere in the range of $30,000 to $50,000 a year. So that's not insignificant for a small news organization. We won't benefit from the tax credit for digital subscriptions because we don't have a paywall, and neither do many digital news startups. But we, over time, the biggest long-term benefit will be the qualified donee status, and I think that does stand a chance to really revolutionize our sector and allow more nonprofit news outlets to get started. For the rest of, you know, it really depends on the outlet. You know, some digital media outlets risk being left out of this package, and that is a real concern, and they risk being left out because of this two-employee rule. So I do hope that the committee is going to revisit that, and hopefully, you know, we'll see these qualifications be fine-tuned in the next version.
Okay. Regarding, again, digital media startups, what could be added to this to help out digital media startups?
I think a lot of, you know, digital media startups, they need money kind of on the front end, and the challenge with this package is you aren't getting a rebate, you know, until after you've employed like two people for a whole year and then you're getting that money back. And so more help on the front end would definitely be advantageous for startups. But I do think that there's a lot of good here if the committee is open to feedback and in improving the criteria.
And then one last question then. So this, from what I remember when it was first announced in November, it's actually a five-year program, right? Do you think this will provide, and ultimately the goal after 5 years is to sort of find new solutions to, you know, how to address this crisis in journalism. Do you think that this program will succeed in that, that it can help, will new methods, new innovations come about because of this, or will it just be more of the same? Are you optimistic, basically?
Well, I think that the qualified donee status in particular is a game changer, and I think that will lead to long-lasting change. The other, you know, two measures, I mean, they're handouts, basically, and, you know, those handouts can't continue forever, and that's why I'm less focused on those, because I think we need to innovate new models for journalism. And, you know, the model that us at the Narwhal and many other outlets are looking at are, you know, reader-funded journalism where people are willing to pay for news that they can't get anywhere else. And the thing with the qualified donee status is it's going to enable people to have a tax benefit for doing so. And so I think that that really paves the way for more of this type of crowd-funded journalism, and that we are going to see more of that model start up.
Well, thank you very much. That was very helpful.
Great.
And, well, we'll stay in touch, okay?
Okay.
Have
great,
a good day.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Adrian Teacher and the Subs, and you are listening to CITR 101.9 FM.
Girlpool will be bringing their ever-evolving sound to the Biltmore Cabaret on April 13th. You don't want to miss this. With guests Hatchie and Claude, grab your tickets at eventbrite.com or Red Cat Records.
Listening to Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM. My name is Alex DeBoer. Thank you for listening. So we're covering the federal budget today, and specifically about the federal budget, we're talking about the media bailout, which was almost $6 million that the federal government, the Liberals, have promised to give over 5 years to improve Canada's media landscape, but they have very specific rules for who qualifies for that money. So we spoke with Jeanette Ageson, publisher of the Taii, as well as Emma Gilchrist, editor-in-chief of the Narwhal, which is a Victoria publication, for those who don't know. So in conclusion, we had a bit of a group discussion as well. So I don't know, I'm here with the News Collective in studio. I'm not sure if anyone wants to add anything else to our discussion of the media bailout quite yet, before we move on to an excellent headline Sam has for us.
Well, again, just to wrap it all up, this is currently a just temporary Band-Aid, and yeah. It should be noted that the crisis in journalism, as we call it, is a global phenomenon. I mean, this True. Is something that every country is going through, and nobody's been able to find a proper solution yet. As you pointed out earlier, Google and Facebook lap up all the digital ad space, and it's just a very precarious industry, both for the media outlets and for us journalists. So hopefully, in this five-year span, that there is going to be Canadian public support, we'll be able to come up with some new innovative ways to solve or find something. Because right now, at this current trajectory, media is just in a free-for-all.
Yeah, definitely. And I'm not super optimistic with this media bailout and the stipulations that are attached to it, to be honest at all. I actually kind of think it might be making things worse, but that's everyone's perspective. And, you know, for example, Emma Gilchrist of the Narwhal thought it was still overall a good thing. And so, you know, it's important to get the perspectives of local organizations and see what they think. But yeah, we'll just stay tuned and see how some of this unfolds, as inevitably groups will bring questions to government. And they'll have to kind of like tease out the specifics a bit more. So we have a headline that News Collective member / comrade Samuel Jones wrote. So what is this? Well,
yeah, so there's a story going around that really caught my attention. Okay. The Vancouver police, you know, they're seeking more victims who were spit on in several assaults downtown Vancouver on Sunday. Weird day for that to happen, if you ask me. Daniel Bielschutz. I'm very bad at pronunciation. We're not sure. He has a last name, this Daniel guy. A 28-year-old Vancouverite has been charged with assault. The police allege he spat in the face of a 19-year-old woman in a wheelchair, I don't even know where to begin. The attack, which police say was unprovoked and random, happened just after 9 a.m. Sunday on Granville Street. Of course, it happened on Granville Street. He appears
just
on camera.
Just don't go to Granville Street.
He appears on camera spitting on the chest of an elderly man and two women. So if you guys are listening, I guess just let the cops know that the guy spit on you. They want to know. Investigators are still really not sure why he did this, but there you go. Spit guy's getting his day in court. So, yeah.
Well, that's a gross story. Yeah. Thank you for sharing. I think we have another headline.
Yeah. So now we're moving into much more serious news in the mainland. The BC Coroner Services recently released a report that showed that there was a 140% increase in homeless deaths between 2015 and 2016.
What percent was that?
140%.
That's a lot.
Yeah.
That's
so more than double. Yeah, so, absolutely. I mean, it's just another shocking reminder of the current opioid crisis we have now, and this is kind of like the beginning of it, because during the same time, it was around the time the province declared that the opioid crisis had begun, or around the time when they announced it. And, you know, 53% of all these deaths were a result of unintentional drug use or alcohol poisoning.
Right.
Yeah, and in comparison, just to the dates before, between 2007 and 2015, this was 34%. So there was a drastic increase.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, and majority of these deaths occurred in Vancouver, followed by Surrey, Victoria. So, you know, just another reminder of what we're dealing with right now.
Yeah, and the homeless count was just done the other day. And we are waiting to hear the results of that and whether The amount of people who are homeless in Vancouver has gone up. So we will find out about that soon. Right now I'm trying to... Oh, please, Chinar, yeah, go ahead.
The homeless count, it just finished, but I believe that the last count in 2018, I believe, was around 2,200, right? 2,200 was the last count.
That sounds right to me.
Around there. Just wanted to confirm that.
Yeah, I think that is correct. Right now I'm trying to... I'm trying to see if we can get the heron camera up. Have you guys all heard about the blue herons who have come back to mate and be in the in Stanley Park near the tennis courts? What do you guys think of that? This is not a slow news day.
Got some really strong opinions here.
Oh wow!
I think they're fine. Yeah, no, I have no strong opinions whatsoever. Yeah, I think they're good where they are. Hope they hang out for a little while. Around. We can get a lot of footage.
Oh my goodness!
It's good to see it's in a federal park because there's a lot of disruption there, which happens to the populations there. Right.
Why does it matter? It's a federal park.
Because the federal parks you have, in comparison to I believe national parks here, because
same
federal parks you have they really encourage people to go there, and that disrupts a lot of the environments there. Because, Stanley Park you have a lot of different park. You have like tennis courts and all that.
Yeah.
Which really, really heavily disrupt, and influence the environment around there. So
yeah. They're telling people not to, go too close and let their dogs out and, disrupt the herons. But, they have chosen this pretty public, populated place to go. Yeah, Stanley Park is super interesting. I'm actually making a documentary on it right now. Funny you ask. So it's actually a federally owned, federal land. The road that runs through it is provincially operated, and it is maintained by the municipal Vancouver government. Super weird, super interesting. I mean, it's not that interesting. It's pretty interesting. So the park board has set up a heron cam, which I think herons are the same as, or blue herons are the same as cranes. These are herons. And so you can actually just Google City of Vancouver heron cam and you can see these blue herons. I'm looking at some right now. Just realized there's no sound though. And... although audio is a visual medium, it is not that visual, and you cannot, as Catherine Gretzinger would say, and you cannot hear them. So anyway, honestly, this has been our show. I've been basically working on an audio documentary for like a week and a half, 2 weeks, which has consumed my life. And so that is going to be on Seeking Office, our podcast, hopefully tomorrow. And it's going to, be so good. It's going to be so good. It's so interesting, right?
I am super excited for it. Thank you
so much. Yeah. It's about the relationship between city staff and city councilors. City councilors are democratically elected representatives, and city staff are appointed, hired by the city, by the bureaucracy itself. Only the city manager is directly hired by the councilors. Anyway, so what is their relationship? How do they share power? They work together to shape the city, to plan the city. What is that dynamic? You're going to find out if you listen to my sweet documentary coming out tomorrow, probably, on Seeking Office. You can subscribe to Seeking Office on Apple Podcasts, which is iTunes. No, wait, is it?
Yep.
iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play.
Wherever you get your podcasts.
Wherever you get your podcast. If you could also rate it. That would be great. Because I'm very competitive and I want to have high. Have you guys all in here rated it, Lyndon? Right now, can you rate it? Have you?
I already have.
Okay, I made you.
I have not yet. I will rate it.
Okay. Well, I'm gonna make everyone in this room rate my podcast. Okay, cool.
Just before we go to Alex, yeah. I just want to make a quick correction here. Oh. Herons are not the same as cranes.
Thank you.
Just so we're not putting false information into the minds of our listeners.
Thank you. I have previously accidentally made fake news when I got a fact wrong. thank you. We strive for excellence. and accuracy. Thank you for listening to this very unstructured episode of Democracy Watch. We'll be back next week on Thursday at 5 p.m. Everyone want to say goodbye in the studio?
Goodbye.
Bye.
Thanks. Stay tuned for more excellent CITR programming coming up.